Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What should we do with young people who break the law? On any given night in America, a little over 60,000 teenagers spend the night in correctional facilities at an annual cost of $88,000 a year per offender. Those locked up are at significant risk for physical and sexual abuse, and their records make it hard for them to find work once they've been released. And if the intention of incarceration is to rehabilitate young people, it appears to be failing. Within 3 years after their release from youth detention programs, 3 out of 4 offenders are arrested again. So what's wrong with the system, and how can we change it to improve both youth outcomes and public safety? Bart Lubow is director of the Juvenile Justice Strategy Group at the Annie E. Casey Foundation, which today releases a new report called No Place for Kids, The Case for Reducing Juvenile Incarceration. Bart, welcome to Think.
Thanks. Pleasure to be with you.
What sort of data does this report take into account?
This report examines data from over a couple of decades concerning a variety of indicators of how well the country is either benefiting or not benefiting from its reliance on juvenile incarceration. So we have summarized all of the recidivism studies that state agencies have produced for their juvenile justice systems. We have looked at 4 decades worth of data regarding abuse and litigation over conditions of confinement in the facilities. We have examined the best data available regarding the cost of confining youth in these correctional facilities. We've examined the data concerning alternatives to those facilities, what programs seem to produce similar or better results at what kinds of prices. So we've tried to pull together under a single cover a much more comprehensive analysis of all the factors that ought to enter into the decision about whether our current reliance on youth corrections is a worthwhile public policy or is a poor use of taxpayer dollars.
I think a lot of people, Bart, assume that kids who do end up in juvenile incarceration are the ones who have committed the worst sorts of violent crimes, rape and murder and, very serious assaults. Turns out that's only 12% of them. Is that right?
That's correct. Part of the reason for that, though, and it's important for listeners to understand this, is that certainly in the 1990s, most states passed laws that criminalized the most serious acts of delinquency, meaning they essentially said, regardless of your age, if you were charged with murder or if you were charged with rape, for example, you're going to be prosecuted as an adult. You'll be tried in adult courts, and if you are in fact found guilty and incarcerated, you'll be held in adult facilities. So the 60,000 number that you introduced this segment with actually refers only to those youth who are being held in juvenile correctional facilities, not in adult correctional facilities. If we added that number in, the number would go up a substantial amount. So within the context of the juvenile corrections system, only about 12% of the youth being confined are kids who are charged with the kinds of serious crimes that you mentioned. They're the kinds of serious crimes, quite frankly, that the average listener tends to think are most appropriate for confinement. The majority of kids who are in these facilities are charged with property offenses. They're charged with violations of rules. For example, they're put on probation and then they break curfews or they fail to follow through on treatment expectations and the like. But they're not charged with the kind of violent offenses that cause the average citizen to be fearful of them.
So if we do have them locked up, it would seem an excellent time to make sure that they're getting a decent education, that they are being treated for any drug problems or mental health problems. Are those services typically available to incarcerated youth?
Well, as the report indicates, first of all, you are correct that the youth who end up in these facilities have a disproportionate set of needs, that is the incidence of underachievement academically, the prevalence of mental health or physical health problems, the special education needs of these youth all tend to be at higher rates than the population as a whole. The facilities themselves do a very bad job of responding to those needs. Educational programming tends to be very undeveloped, and I don't mean to be glib about this. It's a challenge to figure out how to provide a good educational program for a youth who may be in a facility for only 6 months and who's already 4 or 5 years behind in schooling. So I don't. These are complicated things, but the facilities generally do a poor job because they are underfinanced and because it would simply be better to deliver those services in the community. For example, the mental health issue. Youth who are in custody have a higher prevalence rate of significant mental health problems than kids in the community as a whole. That's, you know, sort of an intuitive thing that most people might imagine in any event. The facilities generally are ill-equipped to respond to mental health problems. They don't have enough social workers, psychiatrists, psychologists, or whatever. And perhaps even more important to recognize is that the nature of the facilities, these regimented correctional facilities in which kids report they are routinely afraid and in which they do not feel safe to pursue these kind of deep personal demons, are hardly what one would define as a therapeutic environment. So even if you did have more psychiatrists or psychologists present in the facility, the idea that the environment is one conducive to treatment and to improvement along these kind of axes is simply naive. These are not facilities in which we would, for example, look to have our kids treated if our kids were misbehaving and their misbehavior was somehow related to a diagnosable mental health problem.
So what are we getting as taxpayers for our $88,000 per year per child? I mean, I could send two kids to an Ivy League university for that.
I think, yes, you could. And I think that we're getting two things, basically, neither of which is what we bargained for. So we are getting isolation, that is, we are removing kids from the community for a relatively short period in most instances. But we're getting the security that comes, albeit short term, from having someone incapacitated for a short period of time. And I suppose you could say that we're relieving ourselves for a time of the more complicated challenge of figuring out how do we help kids who have gone off the track to successful adulthood get back on it. So we're putting them out of our minds and into somebody else's hands for a brief period. Some would argue, and I don't think this is an argument that should be trivialized, that there's a third thing that we get, and that's some form of deterrent effect. That is, if kids know that certain kinds of behavior results in a period of confinement, it serves as a deterrent to future criminal behavior. The data on that score is scant, if not completely inconclusive. And when we compared states that had high rates of juvenile incarceration to states that had significantly lower rates of juvenile incarceration, we did not find any evidence of such a deterrent effect.
So in other words, in those states that have higher rates of youth incarceration, the streets are no safer for having put those kids behind bars.
Correct.
One might imagine that the motivation to reoffend is not there if you think you can be sent back into juvenile incarceration. But that's another thing you found isn't happening, so that there's high rates of recidivism, perhaps even higher than youths who were dealt with in a different kind of program than youth incarceration. Is that right?
That's in fact the case. The rates of reoffending across the states tend to be very high. And as you mentioned early on about for states that track these outcomes 3 years after release, they find that approximately three-quarters of the youth who have been in their facilities will be rearrested within a period of 3 years. Of course, there's variation across the states, but that seems to be the sort of benchmark that most of them are hitting. Hardly an admirable track record, and certainly not one that indicates that future offending is deterred by the experience of incarceration or the knowledge of what you're likely to face again if you get rearrested.
So are we breeding better criminals by putting them into incarceration?
Well, certainly there are lots of very credible people who study these issues who would say absolutely. And there's a lot of data that's supportive of that. For example, studies that address the question, if we put low-risk kids into these facilities, do we increase or decrease their odds of future offending, seem to have found that putting low-risk kids in these intense of delinquent culture environments, which is what these correctional facilities are like, makes them more likely to be chronic offenders than if we treat them through other community-based interventions. And all of the research on what are now referred to as evidence-based practices, and these are sort of programmatic interventions with delinquent youth that have been rigorously tested using randomized controlled studies, they have indicated that serving kids in their homes and in the context of their families is a much smarter strategy if what you want to do is reduce bad or risky behavior than putting the kids into an environment with other kids who are also engaged in those kind of risky and bad behaviors.
What about the situation where there isn't a lot of support at home or a stable adult figure in a child's life to try and get them back on the right path? What kind of help can we provide to those kids if we don't put them in a juvenile correction facility?
Well, first of all, I think the system has got to do a much better job of focusing on families and less on focusing on 15-year-olds. That is, it doesn't make sense to me, and I'm a former probation administrator, that our basic approach to working with juveniles is essentially face-to-face interaction between a probation officer and a 15 or a 16-year-old, as opposed to working with the family so that the environment that is most likely to have an influence on the youth socialization can be strengthened. So the first thing I would suggest is we need to do a much better job engaging the families of these youngsters, and we need to do a much better job of developing family-focused approaches in the justice system that break radically from the current client-focused approach that we employ. That's the first thing. Second thing, I think we do have some models now that are really designed to treat the kids in the context of their families. There are a variety of family-focused therapies that, as I said earlier, do much better in terms of reducing delinquency and reducing other forms of high-risk behavior by these youth than interventions that are focused solely on the child. I think we also need to address what I think is at the heart of your question, which is what happens if the family environment is so disorganized or so dysfunctional that it is simply not safe or suitable for a teenager, especially a teenager who is going through problems.
Let me jump in here. We'll take a quick break, and then you can talk about what we can do for those situations. My guest this hour is Bart Lubow. He's director of the Juvenile Justice Strategy Group at the Annie E. Casey Foundation. They have released a new report today called No Place for Kids, The Case for Reducing Juvenile Incarceration. You can find it online at aecf.org. If you'd like to join the conversation now, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning. You can gain a professional advantage with SMU's 9-month intensive CFP program starting in Plano this January. Learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is director of the Juvenile Justice Strategy Group at the Annie E. Casey Foundation, Bart Lubow. The foundation has released a new report today called No Place for Kids, The Case for Reducing Juvenile Incarceration. You can find the entire thing online at aecf.org. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Bart, as we were discussing before the break, clearly there are families that are motivated to and able to participate in their child's recovery from having committed a crime and their child's rehabilitation. There are other situations when, for a variety of reasons, there's simply no trustworthy adult in that child's life to perform that. What do we do in those situations?
Well, first of all, I think we need to think broadly in this sort of as we have, for example, in some of the better child welfare reforms that have been undertaken in many places in recent years. So we used to say, these kids had to be removed from their homes and put into orphanages to protect them from abuse or neglect. And today we have much greater reliance, for example, on kinship care and other alternative forms of living arrangements in home-like environments that work for these kids when the situation is so extreme that they can't, in fact, remain in their biological homes. So the first thing, and this goes to the point I was making earlier about we need to develop an array of family-focused interventions that expands the justice system repertoire for how to help kids get back on the right track and stay on the right track. So it may not be that the immediate parents are able to do the job that you want, but there may be uncles or grandmas or older brothers and sisters. There are also programmatic models that have been developed to address this. For example, there's a program called Multidimensional Treatment Foster Care that has been developed in which very specially trained families serve as surrogate homes for these youth for a set period of time and work very closely, not only with trained therapists, but with the biological parents, so that, in fact, the period of being out of home is not just dead time, but is building towards a time when the youth could return to a strengthened family. Now, that's an expensive intervention, but relative to the cost of youth corrections, it's actually a bargain, and it produces much better results in terms of helping those kids, in fact, be able to remain in their communities, stay connected to their schools, and change their behaviors in positive ways.
I would imagine the one drawback to something as effective as multidimensional treatment foster care is that it's hard to find people who are well qualified and willing to take in a teen with a serious criminal history.
I think it's a problem, but it has not proved insurmountable. Mm-hmm. So, again, it's one of those things where our will and our administrative capacities, that is, how good are we at recruiting these families? I'm sure you're not seeing on your buses or your subways recruitment advertisements for these kind of families. We need to figure out how to do those things better, and we need to figure out how to compensate those families for the special job that they do more handsomely and support them better in that. But, you know, when we're paying $88,000 a year for one of these secure juvenile corrections beds, that's a lot of change to be able to play with to both compensate a specially trained foster family and to provide it with the supports that it needs. So I'm not sure that people aren't willing to step up and take on these difficult tasks, and I'm absolutely convinced that we could do a better job of identifying those families and recruiting and retaining them. I think we have to have the determination and the administrative dexterity to actually increase the volume of such specialized homes.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org. Let's go to the phones now and speak with Anne in Plano. Hello, Anne.
Hi. I really, really applaud him for what he said his focus is as far as family intervention. I know I do work in the mental health field in Fort Worth, and one thing that we've always had problems with is the family. We can try to give these kids coping skills as far as for those that have mental health issues or treatment recovery issues, but some of our biggest problems have had to be dealt with is dealing with the families, with the parents, and how the parents participate. The kid is going right back into that environment where the triggers are all there. And we have made it a mandatory thing for our parents to become involved now on a daily basis as far as going to groups or having special groups with the therapist. But we're starting to, unfortunately, have to reduce those types of programs. But one thing that just breaks my heart is seeing these kids that really do want to try and really are motivated to try, and they go right back into that environment, dysfunctional families.
Bart, what do you think?
Well, I think that the caller expresses a common challenge that we need to do a much better job of responding to. The only thing that I would be cautious about is that we should not be quick, certainly as has been the case traditionally in juvenile justice, to demonize the families. Most of these families are struggling. The adults are struggling with their own problems. They're trying to keep families together in a time of heightened unemployment, with fairly limited opportunities available. We've got to recognize that at some time, at least in juvenile justice, the best research tells us that families really feel disrespected and as if they don't get help. If we want to do a better job of supporting them, including the types of families that the caller was describing where there are very serious problems, we've got to make ourselves more attractive, more understanding, more supportive, more helpful in order to enlist them. And this is especially true in the justice system context, where there is going to be a predictable amount of distrust of those who claim that they're there to help simply by virtue of the coercive authority that the justice system has over their children and indeed over some of the parents. That's why some of the things we've done in juvenile justice, where essentially we end up fining parents because their kids are truant or whatever, are probably policies that produce unintended consequences that work to the detriment of the system rather than to the well-being of either public safety or youth development.
Let's talk about that truancy issue, because there's been a lot of reporting lately about how school districts in Texas as well as elsewhere are really criminalizing things that don't seem to be criminal issues outside of school. So kids are having to be, sent to court to deal with the fact that they haven't been in school. What can we do to fix the problem without necessarily criminalizing, relatively speaking, a minor behavior?
Well, there are a variety of strategies for reducing truancy, and truancy is something that should be reduced because we know that poor connections to school is a risk factor for young people.
Sure.
In terms of delinquency. I would make a separation, though, between issues related to prosecuting truants in juvenile court, which I think is an important debate for all of us to have and a questionable strategy at best, from what I think is the primary dynamic in terms of youth corrections and juvenile courts, and that is the impact of zero tolerance policies on children. So we have passed all these zero tolerance laws. We've placed police officers on the campuses of our schools along with metal detectors and the like. And essentially what we have done has to displace the traditional school disciplinary function and tried to substitute juvenile courts for it. And that's why these days in many jurisdictions, a lion's share, if not the majority, of cases originate in schools for offenses that when I was a child would have resulted in a couple of hours of doing homework in silence after school in the gymnasium. That's what detention meant. Today, it may well mean a secure jail-like facility. That, I think, is the primary kind of criminalization of school-based behavior that we're seeing in the juvenile courts these days, and it has created a huge flow of cases. The labeling of large numbers of kids engaging in relatively traditional adolescent behavior as delinquents with formal court records and court-imposed punishments for things that ought to be better handled by the school authorities.
And another thing that you found is that once kids have been through the system and have those labels, in the same way that adult offenders have trouble finding work after they're released, youth often find it hard to find a job.
Well, yes, it's true that the consequences of juvenile incarceration are long-lasting. Not just in terms of the odds that a youth will continue to recidivate, but they are long-lasting in terms of overall educational achievement and employment history. There are studies, for example, that have found that as far as 15 years out after the juvenile incarceration experience, that youth who were confined will work less and at lower wages than similarly situated peers for whom all other variables have been controlled except for whether they had suffered a period of incarceration or not. So this stuff has very long-lasting effects, most of which we tend not to take into account at the time that we're imposing sentence.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we have Dave in Fort Worth. Hi, Dave.
Hi. I taught in a juvenile detention center for a short period of time, and the kids that we got, we tested when they came in, and most of them were 2-plus grades behind, and that was the cause of their acting out in school and their other behavior and truancy issues. While most programs are successful, and while they're there in achieving some increase in their education level, it's really a special ed need rather than a traditional classroom. I'm wondering if your study recognizes that and could support the increased special education needs for these students.
Well, the study is not explicitly about that issue. We would certainly agree with your experience and your conclusions, and we would argue very strongly for the reinvestment of some of these dollars that are now being spent on juvenile corrections to address the educational needs that you've described as being at the heart of these youth's behavior problems. So I'm very much supportive of the basic idea that you're representing, and we would also support, of course, for the relatively small minority of youth for whom public safety demands incarceration, that the educational services in the facilities to which they may be assigned are strengthened as well.
And let's talk about that for a minute. When you talk about the small minority who absolutely, really, most people would agree must be pulled from society for some period of time because they have done things that are quite dangerous, you think there's a much better way of doing this than putting them in a facility that might be a temporary home to hundreds of kids at a time, and instead they should be in sort of specialized treatment facilities that have maybe just a few dozen kids?
Yeah, the recommendation in the report is that for that small minority of youth who do require some form of secure care, that the best model that we've seen for that is what you find in Missouri, where they operate relatively small. For example, their secure facilities tend to have no more than 36 youth in them. And relatively normalized environments, normalized in the sense that they don't look anything like prisons. They tend to be a much more natural kind of environment with a real therapeutic bent and a very consistent program that the kids go through with a highly trained staff that are deeply committed to their well-being and to them making progress, both educational and emotional. And Missouri's results in terms of recidivism, as well as its costs, all point to it as the model of the future, as opposed to the old, large congregate care training school reformatory youth correction center thing, which is much more common, and does not appear to be particularly conducive to any kind of therapeutic or educational interventions.
I know that this is a nationwide study and that standards and practices vary considerably from state to state, but is it possible to characterize the typical amount of assistance that youthful offenders receive when they are reintegrating into society?
Well, in most places, the reentry assistance is sparse at best, and generally it tends to be something that's slapped together towards the end of the confinement period when a relatively credible community supervision plan has to be put together before the child is actually sent back home. This makes no sense at all. And in many other instances where people have tried to embellish reentry services, the problem has largely been that we're tacking on a Cadillac program after we've put kids through a counterproductive confinement experience. I think Missouri, again, is informative here because Missouri does a number of things that I think are instrumental in achieving good aftercare results. So, for example, the kids are all assigned a single case manager who stays with them from the moment of admission until they are discharged, including being discharged from aftercare, from the reentry community supervision period. They work with the family from day one, from the period of confinement, on reentry issues. What will need to happen in terms of strengthening the family, in terms of providing the right kinds of support when the youth is released. When the kids come out of the facilities, they may either go to a less secure facility temporarily, or they may go home, but they go home and then participate in the day program, where all the lessons that they've learned while confined can be continually reinforced and encouraged. So there are ways to do this, but in most states, there aren't ample resources allocated for aftercare.
Bart Lubow is here. He is with the Annie E. Casey Foundation, which has just released a new report called No Place for Kids, The Case for Reducing Juvenile Incarceration. We'll be back.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning. You can gain a professional advantage with SMU's 9-month intensive CFP program starting in Plano this January. Learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Bart Lubow. He's director of the Juvenile Justice Strategy Group at the Annie E. Casey Foundation, which has just released a new report called No Place for Kids, The Case for Reducing Juvenile Incarceration. You can read the entire report online at aecf.org. If you want to be part of the conversation, send email to think@kera.org or call us at 1-800-933-5372. So, Bart, a lot of people may be aware that Texas in 2007 passed a law that said only young people who have committed a felony are even eligible to be sentenced to juvenile incarceration facilities. What's been the effect of that and similar programs around the country?
Well, that's served in Texas to significantly reduce the number of kids who have been committed by local courts to the Texas Youth Commission. And from our perspective, it was an important strategy, and it is clearly a very decisive way for a state to say, wait a minute, we need to reconsider which level of government is responsible for which group of kids. So that's had a very significant impact on the youth corrections population in Texas, and was an important and bold step by the legislature.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Brenda on the line in Dallas. Hello, Brenda.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Very good show, and I've listened to you every day. I am so glad that your guest is discussing this problem. I live in one of the suburbs here in Dallas, and I want to know what his thought is on this. They've created all of these schools for children that are problem children in the school. So you get to go to an alternative school is what they call it.
Mm-hmm.
And they, to me, it's just a feeder school for the Texas Department of Correction or youth facilities. And I want to know what your guests think about that. And now this is happening right here in Dallas. And I know Dallas Independent School District have them. There's suburbs like DeSoto Independent School District that have them, and I'm not sure where else, but I can talk about the one that I live in. And it to me, I just think that it touches on exactly what he's saying today. So I want to know what your guest thinks about that.
I know, Bart, that you didn't look specifically at alternative schools, but maybe some of the research caused you to sort of take a look at this issue independently.
Sure. I think your caller raises a very common dilemma that one finds across the country. And I want to start with a disclaimer. I'm not an educational expert, and so I won't be drawing on a large array of scientific studies for these comments. But the basic thrust of what your caller indicated, which is that segregating kids with behavior problems into schools, whether we call them alternative schools or by some other label, is on its face a strategy that ought to be questioned very significantly, simply because we know that kids do better in environments where there's a diversity of behavioral types and student types, rather than places where you concentrate all the kids who tend to act out in school. Having said that, let me also say that I am aware of alternative school models that have done a very good job because of how child-focused and family-focused they tend to be of helping kids who were not making it in the routine school district facilities to do better. I think the question, therefore, in my experience, is not simply whether or not we have alternative schools or all kids are sort of mainstreamed, but if we are going to have alternative schools, are they run by special people with really good skills who have the capacity to create an environment in which students who have a history of failure can, in fact, flourish. This week in National Magazine, there's a feature about a judge who we know quite well in St. Louis who's actually established an alternative school primarily for kids who've come through his juvenile court and who were being suspended or expelled from the regular public school system. It is the intensity of the services and the love that is provided to those kids that has created an environment in which they can safely pursue educational ambitions without fear of humiliation or being way behind their kids. Now, I think that kind of alternative school is probably the exception to the routine one that school districts may set up because they have a legal obligation to provide schooling for behaviorally challenging kids. But we can do better with these alternative environments. We've seen that happen. I would like to keep most kids in the regular schools because I think kids do better when they're treated like regular students. But if we do have kids in alternative schools, we got to pay a lot of attention to the kinds of environments that we have created and to the nature of the staff that we've assigned to them. That can be critical to whether the schools can make a difference for these kids.
Have state and local jurisdictions that have tried to reduce the rate at which they're incarcerating teenagers had trouble, had success in getting judges really sort of emotionally and professionally invested in changing the system?
I think that most judges want to do what's best for the kids and what's best for public safety, and they constantly struggle with balancing those goals. So I don't have any questions that the judges want to do better by the kids. I think that judges need to be convinced that there are alternatives that work better for the kids and for public safety. I think we have to do a better job of providing judges with information to guide their decision-making. I mean, after all, if we want to change the patterns of incarceration in this country, from the view from the bench, there are two fundamental things that we need to do. We need to provide more and better or different information about the child who's before the judge so that a more reasoned decision can be made, a better informed decision. And we need to provide the court with a vaster array of options, because if all we have is probation and confinement, for example, judges, like any other human being, will opt for confinement more than they should simply because it's the safer bet.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to do both of those things for judges to buy into this. We need to give them more and better information. We need to give them more and better options. My experience has been that when provided that change of scenery, judges are very eager to keep kids out of these institutions and to create new opportunities for them.
Back to the phones now. This time we have Ed on the line in Arlington. Hi, Ed.
Hi. Well, Mr. Lubow, I think you kind of touched on the answer to my question, but I'll go ahead and ask it anyway. Within the past 30 years in the adult justice system, we've seen, in my opinion, a predominance of the get-tough-on-crime attitude in the public, among the public. And I was wondering if that same attitude has prevailed in the juvenile justice system, and assuming you'll agree that it has, how do you see your recommendations dealing with that, accommodating that, the lock 'em up attitude, throw away the key, elimination of early release, parole, probation, that kind of thing?
Sure. Great question. Juvenile justice has not been different from adult justice in the sense of being immune from these shifts in public policy. I would comment, before going even further into your question, Ed, that we need to distinguish between what the public believes and wants and what people in elected positions believe the public thinks and wants, because lots of public opinion surveys have revealed consistently that, for example, the views of legislators are much more harsh than are the views of their constituents when it comes to issues of crime and punishment. That's probably an understandable phenomenon, given that somebody looking to win votes wants to make clear that they are about public safety and that they're going to be tough on crime. But if you actually do surveys of the public, especially around issues concerning our children, you will find that the public is much better able to discern a difference between juveniles and adults, and that they want for kids the same kinds of opportunities that they want for their own children. Now, we have had a period of real significant harshening. I don't know if that's a word or not, but the juvenile justice system was the subject of a lot of changes in the late 80s and throughout the 90s because of a spike in juvenile violence that occurred between about 1987 and 1993. A lot of harsh laws were passed and a lot of changes were made in practice that we're still recovering from. Right now, I think we are poised to embrace a new national policy consensus about what is the nature of the juvenile crime problem and what should be done about it. We tend to think that the juvenile crime problem is really about gang-banging, gun-toting thugs. But as the numbers that were being talked about earlier about who's in confinement and who's not indicates, we got a lot of kids who are being locked up mainly because they anger or frustrate adults, not because they make the hair on the back of your neck stand on edge with fear. And once we start to better understand and better analyze who really is coming before the juvenile court and what are the public safety risks that they pose, I think it becomes easier to reach a consensus in which we say, gee, this reliance on confinement that we've come to because we only read about those horrible crimes that sort of reach newsworthy level. We don't read about the average delinquent act, and we get a distorted impression, therefore, of what the nature of the delinquency problem is. Once we can reach that new policy consensus, I think we'll see a major shift in how we respond to these kids' behaviors. But it's a long road to convince folks that the thing that has so dominated and animated American criminal justice for decades, which is that incarceration is the pathway to public safety, is not necessarily true, and certainly not true in the case of juveniles.
To what extent does the reality that this is a for-profit business in some jurisdictions where private contractors take over the management of these youth incarceration facilities, to what extent does that cause more young people to be put behind bars because someone's making money taking care of them to whatever extent?
Well, I think that the privatization of corrections is undoubtedly a factor in terms of influencing the direction of public policy. After all, if you're into corrections to make a profit, your primary concern is going to be to expand your market share. And there are only two ways to expand your market share, and that's either you hold people longer in the facilities or you make sure that more behaviors are criminalized and result in incarceration. So there's this built-in tendency in private corrections in making liberty the subject of market forces. There's a built-in tendency to be champions of greater reliance on incarceration, regardless of what it says about public safety results. I think that's a real problem. I think that's why I personally do not think that issues of liberty should be subject to market forces. But I would point out that it's not just in instances where you have a for-profit vendor operating a facility where these pressures exist. The fact of the matter is that correctional facilities provide jobs and they provide a variety of economic relationships, often in places where no other industry is very prominent. And so there's a set of economic factors that are real challenges in terms of the policy shifts that this report argues for, regardless of whether or not the corrections services are provided by for-profit firms or by governmental agencies.
Bart Lubow is director of the Juvenile Justice Strategy Group at the Annie E. Casey Foundation. You can read the report released today at aecf.org. It's called No Place for Kids, The Case for Reducing Juvenile Incarceration. Bart, it's been a really interesting discussion. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thanks for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.